Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Neuro Experience Podcast. I'm Louisa. I'm the host. If I sound different, it's because I'm currently recording this from Sydney, Australia. I frequent Sydney quite often. It's my hometown. I live in New York, but I come back here every now and then. I have to say, my gosh, it's been nice to get out, get some sunlight. I was doing the Coogee to Bondi walk. For those of you who are in Sydney and you are listening, yes, I am here for the first ever Neuro Athletics Coaching Certificate, which will be held at Athletes Authority in St. Leonard's on the 1st and 2nd of April. So if you haven't got your tickets yet, be sure to do so. The link is down below. But moving on to today's podcast, we have got back Max Lugavir. He's back for round two. If you didn't check out round one, make sure you do. Max came on and provided an in-depth analysis about the real cause of Alzheimer's disease. So for those of you who didn't catch that, Max is a science journalist and New York Times best-selling author. He's also on a mission to help people feel better, live longer, and maximize their brain health by optimizing their diet. So in the last episode, we touched on dementia, we discussed public policies around Alzheimer's disease, and we discussed modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors for Alzheimer's disease prevention. In this episode, we're actually going to step away from the public health sector and move more into nutrition. And Max is going to provide an overview on what is good in terms of nutrition. What does the clinical literature say as it relates to clinical data? Like, what does the data say as it relates to Alzheimer's disease and nutrition? And I'll tell you what, no matter how many episodes I do, no matter how many people I talk to, there's always going to be differing opinions. We've got the vegan, or I should say plant-based community that is really strong on the efficacy of a plant-based diet for the prevention of neurodegenerative diseases, especially Alzheimer's disease. But then we've got the, not the carnivore folks, but we've got the mind diet folks. That's where you're eating a bit of everything. You're eating around 70% of plants and vegetables, but you're also having fish, high quality fish, and you're also having some red meat. So then we've got those folks who are saying, no, this diet is the best for the brain and this diet is the best for preventing the onset of Alzheimer's disease. So then we've got everybody listening to this, the neuro experience community, thinking, where do we stand? Do we stand with the omnivores or do we stand with the plant-based people? And so in this episode, it's going to be short, it's going to be sweet, and it's going to get right to the core issue. So I hope you enjoy today's episode. If you do, please feel free to go through and leave us a review on Apple iTunes. This is super important because it helps us push the episode out even further. So right now, I am actually sipping on an Element drink. It's an electrolyte drink mix. It contains 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, 60 milligrams of magnesium. And I have to tell you, it tastes like a lemonade icy pole. So this is the citrus salt flavor. Guys, today's episode is sponsored by Element, L-M-N-T. It is the best electrolyte drink on the market. It contains all of the electrolytes that you need and none of the junk. And this specific formula was formulated to help anyone with their electrolyte needs. So I frankly drink this so often. And one of the best hacks that I've come across is drinking this on the plane. Yes, I had to travel 24 hours to come to Australia. New York to LA is around 6.5 hours. LA to Australia is another 14 hours, plus the layovers. So I have to tell you that this drink was an absolute game changer. It saved my life. Literally, it saved my life. And you guys can actually get some of this. You can get a free sample pack with purchase. So I'm obsessed with this citrus flavor. I'm also obsessed with the chocolate melody. So if you want to check this out and if you want to try it and get your hands on the best electrolytes on the market, then head over to drinkelement.com/neuro, put in code neuro, and you can get an entire pack. It comes with all the different flavors. Watermelon is amazing too, guys. That is drinkelement.com/neuro. You can go through and click the link below in the show notes to take you straight through to the URL. Max, welcome back to the Neuro Experience Podcast. I'm so excited to have you here for part two, which I'm sure this is going to be a bit longer than the other one because we have so much to get through.
Yeah, Louisa, I'm psyched to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about nutrition. You and I have both shared that there is some type of, I'm not sure what to call it, nutrition war on Instagram. It seems that whenever I post anything regarding nutrition, there many people have opinions on it. I never took the nutrition field. So I took a few subjects, obviously, during school, but during college, but I never dug deep into the weeds of it, which is unfortunate because I know that right now, when we look at brain health and the aging brain, and you and I speak profoundly about Alzheimer's disease, we know that nutrition is a huge, huge, huge preventable lifestyle factor that we have to take into place. So let's first talk about the controversy of nutrition on social media.
Yeah. I mean, well, we have what are called the diet tribes.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, and this is because nutrition is something that people tend to, it's not just about what people eat. It becomes their identity. And I think that is a massive problem because whenever you present facts that run counter to somebody's dietary ideology, they take it as a personal insult. It's like an insult to their ego, right? And of course, people adopt different dietary patterns for many different reasons. Some do it, and they're not always transparent about this, but they do it because they are activists, in certain regards, whether it's for, I don't know, the environment or animal rights or, who knows, their stepfather is like, you know, the CEO of some agribusiness. You just never know. And so people tend to feel very, passionate, to say the least, mm-hmm. about their dietary ideology.
Can I just cut in here? When you say that people take it as their identity, let's just take somebody, because I believe that, who may be adopting the vegan lifestyle. So they only hang out with vegan people. They only like vegan people and they really want to, you know, protect that space. So therefore, anybody who's eating meat or advocating for the consumption of meat and dairy is somewhat an attack against them as a religion. That's what you mean, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
100%.
I see that.
And you can see this. I don't mean to single out the vegan community, because, you know, we now have other sort of extreme, diets on the fringes, like the carnivore diet, which is like an all meat diet. Mm. But in my personal experience, as somebody who advocates for both the ethical consumption of, whole animal source products and copious fruits and vegetables, which we know are associated with better health. And mechanistically, we know that fruits and vegetables are very beneficial. I advocate for a very balanced approach, but from my vantage point, the most hateful and vitriolic commenters that I get are they tend to be vegan. It's not all vegans, but that's just what I see from my vantage point, and it's a problem. And I think one of the more obvious illustrations of this is that you tend to see people put their dietary ideologies in their profile bios as well as in their handles a lot, which is like the clearest indicator that somebody has planted a flag into this sort of dietary paradigm. And you're not supposed to plant a flag into your, like on your dietary, your dietary pattern, right? Because nutrition is about science and science is continually evolving. And to think scientifically, You're supposed to always be willing to challenge your assumptions and your beliefs about things. But the minute you plant your flag and say, I'm on a, you know, plant exclusive diet, or I'm a carnivore, then you cease to see reality because you're being, your vision is being colored by this ideology that you've adopted. And one thing that I think is so important for your listeners to take note of is that it rarely works out well when people take their dietary ideologies to the grave. You can't let your ideology influence your biology, but unfortunately you see many people who do that. And then things blow up on social media when you see, for example, which I see often, influencers who, you know, have built brands on eating a certain way. And then all of a sudden it is revealed they are no longer eating that way, right? Like you see vegan influencers who get caught online. This happened to somebody huge. I don't know who, you know, I can't recall the name. But like was caught outside eating a piece of fish. Oh my God.
Oh wow.
Which we know fish is so beneficial from the standpoint of the brain. But you know, like, and so I just think it's a big problem. And again, my approach is one of balance. And I think it's, but that sometimes is the hardest message to sell, because then you're pissing off everybody. Yeah. But yeah, it's a problem. I, at the end of the day, care only about people's health. And learning as much as I can and sharing as much as I can. So the diet wars, I stay as removed as I can from them. But yeah, it is a big problem, and it does harm at the end of the day, because it leads to people being confused about what to eat.
Well,
and I think it's, yeah.
Well, we here at the Neuro Experience community have the same ethos. We're just here primarily for brain health. So, when it comes to brain health, one thing that you are going out and doing in the world is teaching people about Alzheimer's disease. You've personally been affected by this, horrible, debilitating disease. We know that Alzheimer's disease currently affects around 50 million people worldwide. That number is said to triple by the year 2050, but it doesn't have to be. And I want to talk specifically about diets and the best type of foods to have for the brain. I want to talk about both what is good for the brain in terms of nutrition and what's not good for the brain and why. So we can start with why don't we start with what's not good? Let's start talking about trans fats.
Yeah, trans fats are definitely not good for the brain. They're most frequent appearance in the modern food environment actually came to a halt about 10 years ago in the form of partially hydrogenated vegetable oils. Mm-hmm. And so you would see these in any number of products on shelves. They actually were the consequence of the demonization of saturated fat that began in about the 50s. And saturated fat lends a really nice texture to baked goods, among other sorts of products. And one of the things that we all know to be true about saturated fat, generally, is that saturated fats are solid at room temperature. And so when saturated fats got thrown into the doghouse, food manufacturers realized that they could pump vegetable oils full of hydrogen and get them to take on more of a saturated texture and sort of chemistry, right? And so that's how these partially hydrogenated oils came to be. So you could basically take like a dirt cheap, it was also very profitable. You could take a dirt cheap oil, like vegetable oil, soybean oil, and make them appear to behave more like saturated fat. But you could then slap saturated fat free or low in saturated fat on the packaging of whatever ultra processed product you were trying to sell. And suddenly it became a health food, right? The problem is that those fats, we know are trans fats. And we now know, thankfully, that there's no safe level of trans fat consumption. We know that they're essentially poisonous to the cardiovascular system, that they increase risk of the development of Alzheimer's disease. And they even increase the risk of memory impairment among the young and healthy. So this is not just something that like can affect you later on. Now, thankfully, these types of fats we learned, of course, only after a few decades of Americans being chronically exposed to them in the food environment, right? But that tends to be how these kinds of things happen. We know that this product of industrial manufacturing was a terrible idea, and so they've been outlawed. However, trans fats still do exist in the food supply in small amounts in the form of refined, bleached, and deodorized grain and seed oils. Now, these oils are very controversial, and and I've taken a lot of flack online when talking about them, because there seems to be, you know, these oils are the perfect sort of illustration of these diet tribes and how counterproductive to, you know, to good health, like this tribalism can be. But these grain and seed oils actually do contain small amounts of trans fats, very small amounts. But if you're eating a lot of them, as your average American is now doing, you are ingesting a significant amount. Because as I mentioned in our previous episode that we did together, if you have less than 0.5 grams of trans fats in a serving size, you can technically say that you have 0 grams of trans fats. So your average product made with these refined bleach and deodorized seed oils, and just for the purpose of clarity, canola oil, corn oil, soybean oil, vegetable oil, grapeseed oil, those are them. Mm-hmm. You can make a product with them and say that they contain zero trans fats. But in aggregate, with all of the sheer quantity of these types of novel fats that we're consuming now on a daily basis, you are likely ingesting a significant amount of these trans fats, which are created in the deodorization step of the production process of these oils. So,
isn't that what we're eating when we go out and eat at like a restaurant? Let's just say you go and eat Asian food or Thai food. They're predominantly cooking in these seed oils, right?
Yeah. And I think particularly relevant to your podcast and your audience, I think what's really important for people to understand, and again, I catch a lot of flack for this, so I'm not, you know, I don't want people to take what I'm saying as gospel, but these are question marks that I think remain and need to be investigated. We don't know the long-term impact that over-consuming these kinds of, again, novel oils that didn't exist in the human food supply prior to 100 years ago. We don't know the long-term impact that they're having on our brain health. We do know that the brain is made of fat, and particularly the types of fats that these oils are composed of, polyunsaturated fatty acids that are very easily oxidized. They're prone to oxidation. We know that this is mechanistically problematic for the brain. We just don't have the sort of long-term data to say with any certainty that they're safe. So that's why I think that it's important for people to just be cautious and to reduce their consumption of them when they can.
Is there anywhere else, any other types of foods that contain trans fats?
Trans fats, well, yeah, you do find so there are different kinds of trans fats. So that's really important to clarify as well. So just like when you say saturated fat, there are different kinds of saturated fatty acids. You have palmitic acid, you have myristic acid, you have stearic acid. These are all saturated fats. Lauric acid, which predominates coconut oil. They're all saturated fats, but they affect our bodies differently. So trans fats are kind of similar in the sense that there are different kinds of trans fats. And the ones that we want to be most vigilant about avoiding are the artificially created ones. So these are the ones that are either created by the hydrogenation process or created in this deodorization process, which is an integral part of the production of these industrial grain and seed oils. You also find certain kinds of trans fats in the fat of ruminant animals. So, for example, beef, in dairy, but they don't affect our bodies the same way. So one type of trans fat that's found in beef, grass-fed beef in particular, is conjugated linoleic acid. Linoleic acid. Yeah, which has been suggested to possess anti-cancer properties, metabolism-supporting properties. So all research indicates that this is actually not an unhealthy type of fat, even though it's technically a trans fat. So we just have to be really careful with, like, you know, terminology, which is super important. Just like a fat isn't a fat, carbohydrates aren't carbohydrates. For the sake of conversation, we tend to, you know, lump them all under the same roof. But people, I think, should be really cautious with regard to the man-made trans fats. But the ones that are made by nature, I mean, our own bodies are likely producing trans fats to some degree, right? We produce saturated fats endogenously. So, I mean, you know, our biology is magnificently elegant and complex in the way that it, you know, creates and repackages all these different compounds. And so, yeah, that's just, I think, worth important to note.
So what's the other thing that is bad for the brain? Because one thing that I'm hearing a lot of, and I don't know where to go with it, is saturated fat. Saturated fat is bad, but then you've got people saying, but no, saturated fat is not bad. So where do we sit? What is saturated fat? First of all, what foods are they found in? And is it bad or is it good?
Yeah, you brought this up on my podcast, and it was fun to talk about. So this is a really important conversation to be had. So as I already kind of alluded to, there are many different types of saturated fat. So right off the bat, if you hear somebody saying saturated fat is bad, they don't know what they're talking about. Mm. Because saturated fat, there's underneath that, and that was not pointed at you. That was pointed at, like, you know, just the general nutrition tribes. Because that tends to be, you get, you know, saturated fat is like, you know, clogging your arteries. There are different kinds of fatty acids underneath that umbrella, right? Medium chain triglycerides are technically saturated fats, but they don't behave anything like saturated fats. They're not, solid at room temperature. They don't seem to affect LDL cholesterol or anything like that. Underneath the saturated fat banner, you also have stearic acid, which is also neutral from a cardiovascular standpoint and might actually improve mitochondrial function, which is like the energy powerhouses of our cells. Mm. And a cow, stearic acid is named for cows, steers, you know, that's where the name derives from. When you feed a cow its biologically appropriate diet, it has a higher proportion of stearic acid in its fat. And even though we think of the fat in beef as being universally saturated, it's actually not. It's about 50%. I could be, you know, off by a few percentage points there, but it's generally about half monounsaturated fat, and you get a small proportion of polyunsaturated fat, and then you get the remainder being saturated fat. Mm. And of those saturated fats, there's different types. So the main fear that people have around saturated fat is that saturated fat drives up LDL cholesterol, or more specifically these days, we're referring to ApoB, which is the protein on these lipoproteins that charter cholesterol and triglycerides around in the blood. And that's true to some degree, that some saturated fats are able to increase LDL cholesterol. This is for one, heavily genetically influenced. Two, it's not all saturated fatty acids that do this. And three, we tend not to eat single nutrients in isolation. We eat whole foods. So a food that contains saturated fat could have many other benefits going for it that might outweigh the and I'm using air quotes, risk that might be imposed by consuming a little bit of saturated fat. So, for example, you know, red meat, great source of highly bioavailable iron. About 25% of the population is anemic, with about half of that proportion being iron deficient anemic. So, I mean, for that population, red meat is literally medicine. Mm. It also contains a great proportion of vitamin E. It contains creatine, which we know supports brain energy metabolism. So it contains all, and of course, protein. So it contains all of these other good things. And in the context of a whole food diet, do we need to worry about a little bit of saturated fat? I don't think so. I mean, breast milk is loaded with saturated fat, and that's arguably nature's perfect food. Mm. So everybody's going to be different at the end of the day. I don't think that when we're talking about the saturated fats contained in whole foods, and also I would add, meat that is raised appropriately is going to have less saturated fat, than meat that's raised, you know, on a more aberrant diet anyway. So that's where meat quality becomes really important. But I don't think there's anything to worry about in the context of a whole foods diet. And this is not just my opinion. Mm. So the data really seems to suggest that there really is no strong link between saturated fat consumption and cardiovascular disease. You know, these kinds of conditions are multifactorial, And we see again and again with higher quality research that's coming out that whether it's saturated fat or meat consumption, that we really can't say with any certainty that these are bad foods for the brain. Like, we can't paint them with this like malevolent quality that these are bad foods, because in fact, they're highly nutritious foods.
Yeah.
In a time when 90% of adults have at least one, you know, essential nutrient that they're lacking in. And so, yeah, I mean, just to bring up some data with regard to the brain, I mean, there was a, this is something that I tweeted about recently. There was a 2023 meta-analysis. So, I mean, so we're barely into 2023, but a brand new meta-analysis of 33 prospective cohort studies found that dietary intake of total meat and poultry was significantly associated with a lower risk of cognitive impairment. People can check it out. It's Taleb 2023. So that was, I think, super important. We also see there was a 2021 UK Biobank study that found that for every additional 50 grams of unprocessed red meat per day was associated with a 20% lower risk of all dementias and a 30% lower risk of Alzheimer's disease. So this is a massive ongoing study, the UK Biobank study, 500,000 people. There was another systematic meta-analysis. I believe there were two. Recently they came out finding no association with unprocessed red meat consumption and stroke. Right? So, yeah.
Wow.
So, you know, I just think that, like, we really have to get back to a sense of sanity about, like, these foods. Now, isolated fats, that might be a different story, right? Like butter and things like that. But when talking about whole foods, we can't throw the baby out with the bathwater on this. We just really can't. I mean, these are some of our most nutrient-dense foods. And so I implore my readers, my listeners, to welcome animal foods back to the table.
Yeah, me too. You actually, you write a lot about two particular products. I get a lot of, I would say, comments as well. It's dairy and eggs. And I think you mentioned when we were doing a podcast that there's some new data on milk products or dairy found in cheese as it relates to brain health.
Yeah, so dairy is very interesting. The data seems to suggest that people who consume full fat dairy have better cardiometabolic health. Now, this is an inconvenient finding for the vegans in the
audience. Very inconvenient.
Yeah, because dairy has a higher proportion of saturated fat than any other whole food product, even more so than beef.
Yeah.
And yet it's the consumption of full fat dairy that seems to be associated with lower risk of type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that dairy fat is bound up in a membrane called milk fat globule membrane, which is not the most user-friendly of terms, but it basically affects how our bodies respond to the triglycerides in dairy. And milk fat globule membrane is actually, they feed it to infants. They've done randomized like control trials where they'll feed it to infants or they'll feed infants formula without it, because it's not considered a nutrient. It's considered this, you know, this sort of like just happenstance compound that's found in milk. And they see that milk fat globule membrane seems to improve cognition among infants, cognitive development among infants. And wow. So if you think about what develops in a neonate first, it's the brain. And so it would stand to reason that dairy has in it, whole fat dairy has in it compounds that are very beneficial, potentially very beneficial to brain health and cognitive function. And so there's not a ton of data on this, but that study that I referenced earlier, the 2023 meta-analysis, did find that intake of total dairy was also associated with reduced risk of cognitive decline. So I do think it's a great food. Now, the one twist that I'll throw into the mix is that butter seems to be sort of the exception to the rule. And that's because when in the process of making butter, you disrupt milk fat globule membrane. And so that's why there's this paradoxical finding that if you feed somebody heavy cream, you won't see an increase in blood lipids, but with butter, you will over time. And I think it's because even though they're the same product, butter is just churned cream. Butter lacks milk fat globule membrane. And I'm not saying that butter is a food to be eliminated or anything like that. It's just like, doesn't seem to be as beneficial, or might not be beneficial, compared to other forms of dairy.
Yeah. And just on this whole thing, what you're really describing is good food, the way that our ancestors used to eat. And what you're not talking about when we talk about meat and we talk about red meat, you're not talking about processed meats, you know, deli meats. Because I know a lot of people are like, well, does that mean we can eat, you know, a whole bunch of salami? And it's like, well, no, we're not saying that. It's more so the grass-fed raised beef that we're talking about here. I'm not sure if you saw, but there was a recent study out, actually, now that I'm on the point around nitrates being a carcinogen, nitrates in, you know, these foods such as deli meats like ham, salami, pastrami. I didn't realize just how terrible that they could be, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's interesting. So sodium nitrite is typically added to as a preservative to deli meat. And one of the reasons they do that is to preserve color and also to prevent bacterial overgrowth. So it can help prevent botulism. But it does seem to be the case that in red meat, in processed meat, these compounds do have the ability to convert to N-nitroso compounds or nitrosamines, which can potentially be carcinogenic and have an inflammatory effect. But what's interesting is that vitamins, first of all, you can find meat without these added nitrites. So I think that's really important for people to note. So one of the things that I do when I buy sliced meat, which I do occasionally because it's a good protein source, I look for it uncured or without sodium nitrite. The other thing is that vitamin C has been shown to prevent that formation of nitrosamines. So, you know, vitamin C we know is very beneficial in so many ways. It's an important antioxidant, but making sure that you're eating a varied diet that's rich in antioxidants could potentially alleviate any concerns one might have. Not that I'm endorsing the consumption of processed meat, but you know, it just goes to show you that context is everything, right? So if you're eating a nutrient depleted diet, low in antioxidants, and you're eating Subway sandwiches every day for lunch, right? Then that's where this can potentially become relevant.
So then do you believe in the dose makes the poison when it comes to everything, both good and bad?
Yeah, I think dose makes the poison with pretty much everything. Mm. There's one area where it gets a little bit trickier, and that is with endocrine disrupting compounds, which is a whole different rabbit hole. But the dose makes the poison. What that suggests is that with increasing dose, you get increasing danger, essentially. And so that tends to be linear for everything, right? You could drink too much water too fast, too quickly, and you can deplete your electrolytes, and you know, you can like suffer from water toxicity. There's that sort of level for every compound, right? But the problem with endocrine disruptors, again, this is a whole different rabbit hole, but that you might have certain harmful effects at a high dose and then different effects at a low dose. So what they call that is a non-monotonic dose response. And that's one of the reasons why endocrine disruptors have been so hard to study. And another reason why they're just like, there's no consensus on them and why I think it's best to avoid them. And just to be clear, these are compounds that affect your hormones. Mm. And I've written about them in my second book, The Genius Life. Mm. But
you wrote about, you wrote about plastics, I believe.
Yeah, plastics like bisphenols, phthalates, parabens, all that stuff.
Yeah, we're going to have to do a different podcast on that because I want to wrap up on the good, and that is green leafy vegetables. I like them. I've actually been growing my own sprouts. The community here knows that. I eat sprouts almost every day. I just genuinely like them. It turns out that they're also good for you. I don't know why there is some carnivores out there. And I don't know if you believe this too, saying that there's plant defense toxins, or I'm not sure what they're saying, but it's kind of the argument is, you know, from some type of carnivores that plants are not good for you. So let's talk and end with plants and fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, well, I disagree with them. And that's where I get hate from the carnivores. But it's never as bad, actually. They're... you know, I think because I think they feel like that we're I've always said that I'm, you know, that my approach, I'm more carnivore adjacent because I think that like meat has had animal products have had such bad publicity over the past few decades. But anyway, I digress. Yeah, I disagree with them. I think these plant defense compounds are really important, particularly if you're already healthy, right? If you're already healthy and you've got a strong gut microbiome, then these so-called plant defense compounds only help to strengthen the system. And they're found in fruits, they're found in vegetables. I mean, they're found in any number of plant products because they help to ward off, whether it's like critters or fungus, fungal infections or bacterium. Plants develop their own innate defense mechanisms, right? Plants just can't get up and run away or fight off a predator, right? So they become brilliant chemists. And that's where many of these compounds are synthesized.
Mm.
And what we see is that they're actually quite beneficial. There was a randomized controlled trial, just to share a relevant clinical study that used low flavanol, or high flavanol fruits and veggies. And they saw that when, and a control group, and they saw that when they fed the high flavanol foods, but not the low flavanol foods, that subjects had an increase in serum BDNF and also an improvement in cognitive function. So it seems to be that there's like this beneficial effect. When we consume these very compounds that carnivores are out there like fear-mongering, we see that dark leafy greens, that people who regularly eat them on a daily basis have better performing brains, more youthful performing brains by 11 years. That's a Rush University finding, the same group that devised the MIND diet. We know that dark leafy greens have other things in them that are beneficial, whether it's nitrates that can help lower blood pressure, which we know is really important for good brain health, and boosting, you know, blood flow. They're also a wonderful source of carotenoids, which we know are directly supportive of good brain health, like lutein and zeaxanthin. Kale is one of the top sources of these two compounds that we know are so beneficial when it comes to the brain. They're like these plant pigments that accumulate in our eyes. They protect the macula. That's one of the reasons why we've long known that these compounds are helpful in the prevention of age-related macular degeneration. We also see now that they accumulate in the brain. They can help stave off cognitive aging. So yeah, I'm a huge fan of dark leafy greens. I'm a huge fan of plant defense compounds, but you know, I also, something that I always like to remind people is that there's no such thing as a one size fits all diet. So people might have autoimmune conditions. They might have gut dysbiosis. They might, you know, there's all these different, like people come to these conversations with like, you know, such varied backgrounds. And so I'm not saying to go out tomorrow and start, you know, chowing down on the raw kale every day. You've got to see what works for you and your body. And I think that's crucially important. But what I'll say with certainty is that we can't fearmonger these kinds of foods. Like there's a lot of good to be had in these foods. Dark leafy greens are one of our most nutrient dense foods. They're rich in folate. Folate is actually named for foliage, or foliage is named after, folate is named after foliage. And, cause that's where we find it, you know, in such high amounts, which we know is like directly supportive of brain health. It's a great, you know, they're great sources of vitamin C. If you're eating a salad, God forbid, with your processed meat, you know, I mean, you're helping to prevent the formation of those nitroso compounds. So, you know, everything is contextual and nutrition is super complex. But as you mentioned, Louise, as long as you're, you know, eating primarily whole foods, real food, foods that are, that you can cook in your own kitchen, animal products, plant products. I mean, that's like, you know, you're going to be on the right path.
Yeah. And one thing that we didn't talk about, but my community is probably just sick and tired of me talking about EPA, DHA, which comes from fatty fish, like salmon and mackerel. Very big on that. I have that quite often. I'm also having 4 grams a day, actually, of EPA, DHA. Are you doing any supplementation right now?
Yeah. I love magnesium. I also love fish oil.
Yeah.
I think fish oil is great, especially if you don't regularly eat fish. So yeah, consuming a high quality fish oil supplement, I think can be really helpful. I take creatine, on a regular, we talked about this on my podcast. Yeah. I take creatine every day, 5 grams. I think men, especially older adults seem to really benefit. There was a meta-analysis that came out looking at, creatine and its impact on cognitive function, especially if you're an older adult. You know, don't take any new supplement without checking with your doctor first, but generally it's creatine's a very safe supplement. And I take it not necessarily for the cognitive aspect of it, but I take it because it's a great like performance boosting supplement for, you know, exercise. I also am a huge fan of protein powders. I take a, you know, whey protein supplement on a regular basis. And then I take a supplement called astaxanthin, which is like a fish carotenoid. So we've talked about carotenoids in dark leafy greens. Astaxanthin is found primarily in wild salmon. It's a really, really powerful antioxidant that I think probably is very, supportive of brain health. A lot of good data on it.
I love that.
So I've been taking that for about 15 years at this point.
So have you spoken about all of these in your books, in your cookbooks, in The Genius Life? Like, have you got all of these listed out there for everybody to read?
Yeah. So Genius Foods, my first book, is really like, an encyclopedia for this topic. You know, if you're interested in, cardiovascular health, gut health, like it really is. And I wrote it for any skeptics out there with a medical doctor who was an obesity medicine specialist. And, it really is like, you know, I think best, obviously I'm biased, but I don't think there's a better book to read to gain a grasp on just how plastic the brain is and how responsive the brain is to good food. With all the mechanisms and, you know, risk factors and everything. So anybody with a risk, concerned about their risk for neurodegeneration should definitely check out Genius Foods. That's book number one. And then book number two was called The Genius Life, and that goes more into the environmental aspects of good health. As I've mentioned, you know, some of the environmental toxicants that we're exposed to, like these endocrine disrupting compounds, that's book number two. And then book three puts it all together, and it's a cookbook. So there's lots of beautiful photos and stuff like that. So yeah, I've put a lot of work out there. And also, if you're a clinician, I got to co-author a chapter in a textbook. So I've actually gotten to publish academic, writing on, in a book called The Handbook on the Neuropsychology of Aging and Dementia. Mm. And I co-wrote a chapter in it called The Prevention of Cognitive Decline. So people can check that out if they happen to be practitioners, which I know you have a large audience of, you know, people from all different paths. So. Yeah.
I'm going to link all of that below, and I can't wait to read that last one. But Max, thank you so much for being part of the Neuro Experience podcast once again. And you hang out mostly on Instagram, right?
I do. I hang out on Instagram. I've been pretty active on Twitter.
Yes, I saw that.
I saw your recent viral tweet. That was really funny. we don't have to go there, but follow Louise on Twitter. So I'm on Instagram and Twitter both.
Okay, we'll link
that. And then I host my own podcast called The Genius Life, which you're on.
Yes, you do. We're going to link that too. Very excited for our episode to launch. Thank you, Max, for being part of the Neuro Experience podcast.